Let's talk. John Brown. I bid you farewell. No, that's not me leaving you early for this show. I bid you farewell. It's all about the life of an auctioneer. It captures the drama, wit and wisdom of a lifetime in the antiques trade, set amongst the backdrop of Suffolk's market towns and quiet villages, Lanham's charts, an era of remarkable change in the auction houses. I'm delighted to say that the man behind the gavel, the author of I Bid You Farewell, Neil Lanham, joins me live online. Neil, can you hear me?
Yes, I can.
Good to have
morning
you.
Morning all.
Good morning all indeed. Whereabouts are you on God's green earth this morning?
I'm in sunny Suffolk.
Very nice.
Well, I was born and bred.
Very nice part of the world. So tell me a little bit about then how you sort of fell into, what attracted you to the cut and thrust, the drama of the life of an auctioneer?
Well, in a nutshell, father died when I was five. I wanted to be a farmer, brought up on grandfather's farm, but we had no money for that, so it was deemed that I should be an auctioneer. But I was a nervous boy, I got sort of kicked around, didn't get the best of jobs. But what really put me on the map, if you like, was I got a job with this old boy in a derelict firm in Haverhill. I didn't realise it, but he was dying, and he died after in there 6 months. They tried to sell it. No one bought it. No one wanted it. And they let me manage it, and then I could... Youth has enthusiasm, and that's worth an awful lot. And so I bought it. And although I made mistakes, of course, built up the estate agency and then sold that. I had four offices then, sold that off. But I was still only about 25.
Right.
And I just went back to my first love, which was auctioneering. I'd been at a firm called, it's now called Cheffins. They held the largest sales of farm machinery in Europe.
Right.
And I got a job in a rural cattle market in East Suffolk, which is beautiful because the community was intact. But anyhow, from there I went to with Mr. Boardman. He died, and I was lucky enough to be on my own. Nobody wanted this firm, but the town was a London overspill town, and the property soon took off. And then I sold that side, and I went back to auctioneering, which I thought I had a bit of talent at, and antiques. And we, from the town hall there, in Suffolk, we then, I think it was through psychology, really.
Right.
If you ask me, we made over 100 world record price from that little hall. And I remember a dealer coming into the sale one day, and he said, "Don't forget that whatever lot that you sell to anybody, they are on an ego trip."
Right.
And I thought about that, and I thought, well, they come here to this hired hall in the sticks. We'll give them what they want. But the thing about it is you had to know what you got when it came in. And for this, I discovered a saying by the famous Rudyard Kipling. And it was worth a sack of gold to me.
Wow.
And he said, "I had six honest serving men, and they did serve me well. There was what, there was where, why, who, how, and when." When you look at an object, if you can tell what it is, where it was made, how it was made, those six things, you know everything about it. And I used that, and I also used it to find the man in the world who might buy it. And I think that I discovered that so much went into London and came out again.
Yeah.
Our local competitors who were a branch of a London firm, said, "Why send to Boardman's over there when we can get it for you in London?" But it's not about London and Suffolk. It's about the article and what you can put into people's minds. And I realised that if you and I went to a sale in the big London sale rooms,
yeah,
and we bought something, we'd come away feeling we'd given one bit more than the biggest buyer in the world. But if we discovered it, it's where the psychology can, in a sleepy Suffolk sale room, we'd identify with buying it. And if we saw our biggest competitor when we got there. Oh, well, I'll make him pay. Now, that psychology is worth two of the London thing. And but you have to know what you've got. So what I did was I took the catalogues of all the major London sale rooms.
Yep.
I didn't ask people, anybody, what I thought, because they didn't have a vested interest in it. They give you a throwaway idea. And also, it's important to keep your mouth shut and keep your secrets. And if you ask, you can only ask a dealer, and it would be out. So I kept my mouth shut. About this time, Wilson devalued the pound by 14%, in 1668, and a load of people started coming in from the continent, from Europe, Holland, Germany. Before that, it had been absolutely dead. And with this newfound thing, we prospered. Now, I think the third story I'd like to tell you was we had a French commode, and it was Buhl. And Buhl is brass marquetry, and nearly every piece you see is made about 1900, and it's been stamped out with a machine. But the real André Charles Buhl was a cabinet maker to the Louis XIV in France. And this woman had had bad advice, and I knew her well, and someone told me about it, and she had this Buhl commode, and I said, could I see it? And she said, well, there's no harm in you just looking at it.
Right.
So I went to see it, took a photograph, all my catalogues of the London sale, I gave this photograph to a girl in the office. I said, go through all the Paris sales and everything like that, and all the brochures that we've kept, and find anybody who's ever exhibited at a Paris exhibition or anything like that, and we'll send them free catalogues, right? I say that because my competitors, they wouldn't sell their catalogues out unless they were given £3 for it. Bother that. I'm not about selling catalogues. I'm about selling the goods. Anyhow, we got this commode into the sale room, and lot of interest in it. People came from France, particularly. One man took off every escutcheon, looked behind it, and when the I did not give estimates. This woman had found out that one. And the biggest sale, normally they'd make about 10,000 or 12,000, but one had made 20,000 at the biggest sale, meant more, biggest sale in Europe for years. And she said, you can have it if you have a reserve of 20,000 on it.
Right.
Now, I kept absolutely dumb about that. Nobody knew, only myself, my wife, and my secretary. So when the sale came round, and I'm selling a lot, and I said, start me, gentlemen, please, where you will. And I poured myself out a glass of water, and I waited.
Right.
And the psychology of the sale room, to me, came into force, because he was one of the biggest dealers in Europe, had a place in Bond Street, London, and he said, £1,000, sir. Now, a poor auctioneer said, oh, no, that's not enough. Make it 10. No, I had none of it. Thank you. Be positive at all times.
Right.
Thank you very much, sir. And away we went, 1,000, because I knew the next bid was going to be 2,000. I wasn't going to let anybody say 1,100, 12. 1,000, and I went to immediately. Some went 3, 4, 5, 6, 7. Got to 20,000.
Yeah.
And it went on. And it went up to 32,000, world record price for such a piece of furniture. This is in the 60s.
So that was not a small amount of money there.
Oh yeah. But the thing I want to tell you is we didn't have a phone in the hall. We did not even have a phone. And you imagine that. And there were Frenchmen running outside from the hall to a telephone kiosk, I was told.
Oh.
And then the other difficulty, it was a time when we had to sell it. We had to send it to France without being paid before we were allowed to be paid. It was because poor old Blighty was very hard up at that time.
Yeah.
And then Wilson devalued the pound, and these Continentals came into the sale room, and they wanted oak furniture. And I had a friend who's John Tasker, who's an antique dealer in the Midlands.
Yep.
And I said, go out and buy all the oak if you want any more, if I haven't got enough money, which he did. And We satisfied, well, no, we didn't satisfy the demand. It was insatiable, really,
yeah.
Because there was now a fashion of raiding old England. And we then had the largest sales of period oak furniture in Europe. And it went on, but the oak market crashed. And then Mrs. Thatcher came to power.
Right.
Now, when Mrs. Thatcher came in, she sold off the public utilities,
yes,
which really belonged to you and me and ordinary people, and we had the money back down our throats in lower taxes. And suddenly, English people came back to the sale room. We used to laugh if an English person bought things in this continental age, and it was now an English market. So we changed. But the big thing was I was on my own, and I could change. As soon as we knew the oak was coming in, I changed my method. And we went to the oak and had the largest sale of oak furniture in Europe, from a standing start. And then we had big sales of mahogany. To bring out little pieces, I went to Tissington Hall in Derby for a set of mahogany chairs.
Yep.
They were Chippendale Gothic. They were rare in an important book.
Yeah.
We put a reserve of 50,000 on them. Advertised them in America. You've got to advertise. Advertised America.
Yeah.
And they made 85,000. That was another world record price. All from this sleepy town hall in Clare, which people loved coming to. But I say it was only the psychology that if you and I went to London, we'd feel we'd given one bit more than the best buyer in the world. Whether when it came up in our sale room in Suffolk, as long as we knew the people who might buy it, and we did our research for that,
yeah,
you could make them turn on, and that was the reason why we made over 100 world record price scissor auction from this backyard place.
Can I ask you a couple of questions on the backyard? A couple of bits and pieces. One of them is the fact that, you know, in my other job, I MC a lot of events. You know, I do charity galas, that sort of thing. And
yes,
so you are invariably asked, because you're trying to raise money for charity, Giles, can you do an auction for us as well? Would you mind doing?
Yes, yes.
Now you mentioned that thing about the no reserve, and the reason I say this, and you probably haven't been this because you're good at what you do, and I'm not. Yeah, but there is. I did a big gala about 5 years ago, maybe longer,
yes,
and it was on the polo fields of Soto Grande, right? So it was a big event, 600 people. They'd all paid a lot of money to be there.
At where?
At Soto Grande, which is a polo field down in near Gibraltar. Okay, so
we've got
beautiful evening. We've got the Malaga Symphony Orchestra. We've got people come over from the opera house to give recitals, and I'm doing the auction. Okay, and there were three items, and each of them, one was a day on a big yacht. Yeah, the other one was a day on a supercar, and the other was a piece of artwork which the artist was actually there with me, which is the Kiss of Death, as I was to find out later.
Yeah, I would think that.
Yeah,
right,
but they all, I mean, everything had a reserve, okay? I mean, the artist,
yes,
didn't want to let his go for less than 3,000 euros. The,
yeah,
the boat was going to go for less than 5,000 euros, and the car,
yeah,
was something less than 15,000 euros. And nobody bid, my friend, and there is no more lonely feeling in the world than standing,
well,
being an auctioneer when nobody bids. So how do you get around that? What advice would you give to me? Yes.
I wouldn't have put down there that we'd got these high prices on it.
Right.
Because you just kill it. Everybody thinks they want it. The psychology, the auction room is where you go to get bargains, right?
Yep. Okay.
And you've got to get them going. That's why don't start high and have high estimates and things like that. You need low and let everybody think that they're going to get a bargain. It's not about what the auctioneer does. It's about what the people in front of you do. And that is you've got to make them think. And you can make people bid. You can make people bid from the rostrum with a little bit of psychology.
Right.
Because people bid and they lose confidence. And if they're private people, I would always give a big smile and a nod, and I've never failed to make people at least have one more bid, maybe two. And so there's an enormous psychology about the whole thing, where you sell it. People want a bargain. If you have anything that wants restoring, don't touch it. because everybody in that room knows that they're the best person to know how to do it up.
Right.
And if it's done up, oh, look what someone's done with that piece, however good it's done. Are you with me?
Yep.
Don't touch it. They all wanted it. And it was like these people, they all thought they're raiding old Britain. We had a French, and we had an American chest.
Yep.
It was 17th century painted Pennsylvanian. The woman had bought this been bought for her in the United States for $10,000. And she sent it to us. She said, shall we send it back to... I said, no, I'll make more in Clare. So I advertised it over there to get the right people interested. And they love raiding old England. This shouldn't be there. At this hick auctioneers down in Clare in Suffolk. They're going to buy it. They're going to buy it. It didn't make 10,000. It didn't make 20. It made 23,000. We also had a picture by a New Zealand artist.
Yeah.
And belonged to a local man. And he said, I suppose I want you to sell. It was the contents of a boardroom of a big factory that had closed.
Yeah.
And he had some good pictures. He said, this is by the New Zealand artist, Blomfield. He said, I expect you'll... we want you to handle it, because he'd had a bad time with some other auctioneers, say no more. And thank you. Yes, we will. He said, will you send it to New Zealand? I said, no, we'll make more in Clare.
Yeah.
But don't you want to send it into London? No, no. And I had an advertising agent. We advertised it in a New Zealand paper, and there was this, and there was a London man who came down who had colonial exhibitions. Now think about it.
Well, that sounds good. I like the sound of that. A colonial exhibition. What was in that?
He can't have something that's been bought out of New Zealand, can he?
Yeah.
He's got to have something like that. Anyhow, the highest price, this is again in the 60s, was in New Zealand, was 12,000. We made 23 of ours. We doubled the price.
Yeah.
We doubled the price. And the whole thing was down to psychology. And I tell the psychology in the book of how we did it.
How important, how do you manage to keep the figures in your head? Because, again, sometimes I wonder...
That's another thing. This is all in the book.
Yeah.
When I was at school, we had a maths master who'd say, what's 225 times 6 plus 118? Three things. And I was fairly quick in putting my hand up. And when I left, he was the only master who gave me any prospect of doing well. And when I think about it, when I got in the auction room, you've got to hold three things in your head at once. You've got to hold the bidding in the sale room, who's the last bidder, so-and-so. You've got to hold the reserve, and you know you mustn't sell it below that figure. You can't get the people in on the off-bid. Do you understand me?
Yeah.
The off-bid is. You've got to get them dead on the reserve. And then you'll have other people who've left absentee bids that you've got to bid for. So you had to carry three things in your head. That was a learner for me. I would say that I loved it in the rural East Suffolk place.
Yeah.
And there was banter in the sale room, always banter. When I bought this firm, they had an old clerk there who'd started in the firm in 1898.
Blimey.
And he had no end of stories. And the title of the book is one of his stories. And his story was, Mr. Boardman was trying to sell this poor old cow, and he's asked £10, £8, and there's a bloke, a dealer from the local village of Horseheath trying to bid, and he's trying to bid, and he didn't see him, and he shouts, Mr. Boardman, can I bid? Why, of course, Jack, you can. He said, then I bid you farewell.
Ha-ha!
And there was banter like that all the time. but we lost it with the modern internet and
yeah.
things like
well,
that.
Well, I suppose that's the thing, because, I mean, if you go, I mean, I remember because, you know, back in, and again, in the
Hello, this is Gavin Essler.
Hello.
Speaking.
Oh, sorry, that came in, so, excuse me, that came in for no reason. Because, you know, I used to go into Sotheby's and Christie's as you know, when I was a bit younger, and there's a very sort of, I mean, that's all full of Tristans and you know, Phoebes, who are these young auction, you know, these young researchers or whatever. And then I went down the Lots Road, and that was much more fun, because that was, you know, that was literally people.
I know those places,
exactly.
Lots Road had a good never went there, but it had a good reputation.
Because it was the banter, and I think a lot of people think that, maybe the modern, the internet bidding and the whole thing. But, I mean, auctions should be fun, shouldn't they? They shouldn't be sort of this very,
Absolutely.
Very po. Yeah.
And in the old days, there was all this banter. And when you get on the rostrum, it's amazing the humour that comes out. I remember when I was in the cattle market, and we used to sell everything.
Yeah.
We used to sell everything from cattle right the way down to pigs, and we used to write the counts out that night. And sometimes Christmas sale would be there till midnight, because it was traditional that the counts went out the next day, and we had to write them out and do all the accounts. What was I going to say about that? You know, I was going to tell you something then that's gone out of my mind.
How much theatrical, how much of an actor do you have to be? How much of a showman do you have to be, Neil, for?
Well, at the end of the day,
you
shouldn't really be seen to be, you're like a good referee, you know, after a football match. How did the ref get on? I don't know, I can't remember. He was a good referee. And you are that person, and you've got but you have these people in front of you. Now it's different, they're half of them on the internet. But you have these people in front of you, and you've got to develop their interest in it. That's why I would always start low. Get them in, get it organic, get people, get their egos going, and that sort of thing. But that seems to have gone out the window now. I did enjoy it, and as I say, particularly the banter, there was always. Do you want another story?
Give me one more otherwise I'm going to crash the international news. But give me one more story, Neil.
Right. Well, we had this sale at the Undertakers, and
I'm sorry, you had a sale at the Undertakers.
Undertakers, yeah.
What, you were getting rid of coffins?
He was
stuff?
Packing up.
Okay.
I don't think he had enough business.
It was a dying
stuff.
Market, etc. Tish Boom, we're here all week. Yeah.
Right. So the governor was selling, and he was standing on his coffin boards in the joiner's shop, and one old boy, we used to have a local old Suffolk tobacco, was Churchman's counter. It was black shag, and they used to smoke this, the old boys did.
Right.
And the smoke was drifting up, and the governor was shouting, £20, and the smoke got in his lungs, and he coughed fit to die. And one old boy shouted out the crowd, said, do you think, sir, while you're selling them coffin boards, you ought to keep one lot back? Does that look as though you're going to need it yourself?
Ah, brilliant.
That was fluent, and I loved it. Anyhow, my book is available in all good bookshops.
It is, and they can order it as well via our own virtual bookstore now. They just click on the link, and it'll be winging its way to them.
Good.
The book is called I Bid You Farewell, The Life of an Auctioneer. It's by the brilliant Neil Langhan, who's speaking to you today. Neil, sir, I've made my notes. It's been an absolute pleasure to speak to you, and I look forward to doing my next auction with your notes, sir.
Thank you very much for a very good interview.